All right, what about existentialism as a possibility? Sire has a very good chapter on that. I'll deal with this quickly. I think postmodernism is more of our problem now, not so much existentialism. But you have a two-story view here. The individual creation of value, meaning, value, purpose, significance, which is subjective, and then the world of science and facts. Now, this is different than Kurtz in that Kurtz is very upbeat and optimistic. Where if you're considering Camus or Sartre, it's much more pessimistic. Sartre said things like, man is condemned to be free. Man is a useless passion. The notion that it's a closed system of natural law, but there's a radical subjective-objective split. So somehow human beings come onto the scene and they have freedom. And we define our own essence, which is a metaphysical non sequitur. It makes no sense whatsoever. But somehow existence precedes essence, and you create your own essence through your choice. There's still some of this around in our culture. This emphasis on freedom, being unfettered, being an unencumbered self. No one can tell you what to do. You tell yourself what to do, that idea. So somehow freedom comes into existence from necessity. The objective world is absurd in and of itself. It's not just there. It's absurd. There's no purpose, meaning, or value to it. It's a brute fact. And it's not a wonderful playground, but it bears down on you with a sense of absurdity and fortuitousness. So Sartre argued that you must own up to your freedom. You can't say your genes made you do it, your environment made you do it, your social group made you do it. You have to realize you're free. Freedom is rooted in literally nothing. Freedom just popped into the universe for no reason and no cause, kind of an ex nihilo creation event without a creator. But we are free. We're just thrown into this environment. Heidegger used that sense of thrownness. We're just here. And Heidegger said we're beings unto death. There's a happy thought. We're beings unto death. And so we have to sort of create our own identity through this radical choice. But it's not like postmodernism. And the postmodernism says that yourself is a creativity, is a creation, rather, of the collective. The self dissolves into this larger cultural matrix and language games. Existentialism had a hard individual sense of the self, like the self revolting against absurdity. Camus' The Plague is a classic example of that. A hero against the absurdity of the world, a saint without God, requires a certain amount of tenacity and rectitude and focus and idealism that you often don't find in postmodernism. There's a kind of heroic quality. But the heroism is a mysterious upsurge that just dies when it dies. So there's no larger meaning. The self has no objective moral law to appeal to. Sartre tries to get out of radical relativism, but he ultimately can't. He says, well, we choose for all people. We choose before the audience of all people. But in the end, if God does not exist, everything is permitted. He agrees with Dostoevsky's line from the Brothers Karamazov on that. God does not exist, everything is permitted. But we must be free. And we are condemned to be free. Well, the freedom has no meaning. There's no criteria for choices. So we just have to invent. Sartre has a famous story. I used to teach hours and hours on Sartre 20 years ago, but now nobody reads them, so I've condensed it. But Sartre has this story where in France, during the resistance, a young man came to him and said, I have obligations to my mother, but I want to join the resistance. I can't do both. Which one should I do? Sartre utters the famous words, invent. There's no world of ideas, no heaven of ideas, no fixed moral principle. So you just have to invent in your own freedom, whether you join the resistance or whether you continue to stay with and protect and help your mother. Invent. That's what it comes down to, a kind of arbitrarianism. I mean, we can critique this in all kinds of levels, but very quickly, on the metaphysical level, the sense of freedom makes no sense at all. Where does freedom come from in this impersonal, materialistic world? It just It's just there. Again, it's another just there quality, a complete surd, brute fact. And when Sartre tries to make moral statements, for instance, when he condemned the war in Algeria, he made an objective moral statement, which he had no basis for making. And a lot of the existentialists at that point wrote him off. Where does Sartre come down making objective moral statements that everyone should agree with, given his philosophy? So you have a very unstable view metaphysically and morally. Now, there's another view I want to spend a little bit of time with. This is kind of a strange one. But before I get to that, questions, comments on existentialism? You ever taught that in school? You ever see that in movies? If you ever watch Ingmar Bergman films from the 50s and 60s, you see existentialism everywhere. If you ever watched any of the old Woody Allen movies from the 70s, Annie Hall, those kind of movies, you see existentialism. Yes. She is a naturalist and she calls her philosophy objectivism. She hates existentialism because it's so subjective and she thinks irrational. Supports a free market view, has the view of the self as free, able to understand truth. She thinks the law of non-contradiction is the foundation of all reasoning. She's an atheist. She believes in moral properties without God. Actually, it's the next view we're dealing with. So she's a naturalist who thinks there are objective moral properties without God that are just there. Okay. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm dealing with atheistic, but that's a big question. Sire has a pretty good summary of it in the book. But we'll put it this way, the good elements of theistic existentialism want to personalize doctrine, to show the relationship of God to human beings, that these are not merely abstract truths, but they have a bearing on your life. And Sire has those two columns where you can take a doctrine abstractly put and make it more in terms of the personal effect on human beings. The problem with existentialism applied to Christianity is that it tends to write off apologetics. What matters is your personal meaning before God. So any kind of really abstract technical apologetics is considered too far away from the self, too far away from the guts of the person, too removed from everyday life. Now, Kierkegaard had his own method of apologetics, and in fact, if you ever read his book, The Sickness Unto Death, he gives a kind of existential analysis of the self and of sin in the self. And that book is one of the reasons why I'm standing here today. It's one of the books that I read that had a tremendous impact on me becoming a Christian, because that book haunted me. When I was reading it, he was describing my own self and my own sense of sin. He wasn't talking about the resurrection, arguments for God's existence. He was giving kind of a Christian phenomenology of the self as a sinner. And it rang so true that it haunted me. And that's very powerful. But where I think Kierkegaard is wrong is that we have all kinds of arguments for metaphysics and epistemology and value theory for the existence of God. And we also have his kind of existential approach in terms of exegeting the self in Christian terms. But the fideism, the disparagement of natural theology, I have to reject all that. That's a short version. I could say so much on that one. All right, let me talk about this other view quickly. That is, all right, we'll bite the bullet. Some things are morally wrong, some things are morally right. It's not a matter of natural properties. It's ethical non-naturalism. But there's no reason to posit God. We know that crashing airplanes into skyscrapers is wrong. It's objectively morally wrong, period. We know that defrauding people, stealing is wrong. How do we know this? It's just a fact of the universe. There are moral facts as well as physical facts. There again, what? Just there. Now, what this worldview is doing is taking something that's classically a part of theism, objective moral reality, ultimately comes from God, related to God's creation, take that morality and divorce it from God. So when you argue with this kind of a person, you don't want to give all the arguments against relativism. They already believe them. What you have to do then is try to say, wait a minute, does it make a lot of sense to claim that there are objective moral facts that are not reducible to natural properties without God? Now, how would you begin to argue that? Have you run into anybody who's held this view? Yes.
Somewhat. My Buddhist friend that I mentioned before brought up the moral argument with him. It kind of reminds me of what you're talking about now in Rob theory. So that we know what to do and what not to do because we know what we do or do not want people to do to us.
And that's all you need.
In that sense, it's just there. It's built in because we know how we like to be treated.
But then you have to connect that with other people, and you need values that obtain objectively. So I think there are objective. Yeah. Well, this view says there are objective moral values. Now, okay, fine, but how do they relate to human beings on this view? See, on this view, the universe is just there, the values are just there. We were not created to know these values, we just happen to know them. Somehow, human beings evolved through chance and necessity and developed the moral capacities to connect with these immaterial moral facts. Surprise! You know, I mean, it just happened. No purpose, no reason, no design. It just happened. It's another brute fact. How probable is that? Even given the existence of these moral facts, that entities would evolve by chance and necessity without design, without purpose, to know them and to be able to put them into effect. See, this is not theism. This is not a teleological worldview. This is an a teleological worldview. There are moral facts, but there's no teleology. That's problematic. Yeah?
How do they account for different belief systems within different cultures?
Well, they might say that some people's cognitive equipment is impaired, and they're not rightly related to these moral principles that transcend their cognitive capacities. They could pull that off. See, they're not making moral facts dependent on consciousness. They're saying they exist apart from consciousness, but not in God, because it's an atheistic view. Malfunctioning? Well, I suppose you have to appeal to teleology then. If they're functioning correctly, they get you in touch with these objective moral facts.
Well, he's saying, you know, that there's a different, how do they deal with different frameworks that might not be in touch with theology? And just given a whole society, you know, how they're doing it, everybody in society has been malfunctioning, cognitive abilities,
out of touch. Well, I mean, you do have a question of authority. If you say they're there, then what are they? And who determines what are they? Because remember, you don't have revelation in the Bible. You don't have a God making it known through conscience. It's just there, and somehow we have evolved to know these things. So you have to siphon out all the teleology, which makes it difficult. Moreover, when you think about moral life, when we have done something we know is wrong, we feel guilt. I mean, I think guilt is the most appropriate emotion before a person. It's not just that you violated a standard, but that you have offended a person. It seems like the phenomenology of guilt, which is cross-cultural and which has been going on from day one, maybe day two, is indicative of a sense of feeling that you've done something wrong before an audience, that somehow there's a sense of guilt or shame before an audience. Now, if that's the case, then you would need to have a personal being who is the source of the moral law. I mean, moreover, why should there be these moral values in an otherwise random, impersonal universe? And how can these laws obtain without a commander? The sense of the imperative here, right? you ought to be kind to the poor, you ought not torture the innocent. These ought statements, I think, make the most sense or better explained in terms of a personal worldview. See, this is an impersonal worldview. It's like you're taking, if you will, God's moral thoughts and then taking them out of God and throwing them into a random universe, a universe where you only have natural law and chance and matter. And you just throw these ideas in there. But they're moral ideas and ideals without a mind that holds them. I mean, that's ontologically very unstable. Because if moral principles are propositions, then they're really thoughts, right? And can you have thoughts without a mind? It's like if you have a thought, you have a proposition, you have a thought, you have a thought, you have a mind. That at least makes good sense. Whether it's a necessary connection, at least makes very good sense. Now, in this case, you have, if you will, moral thoughts, at least moral propositions, that are not necessarily in any mind. They're just in the universe, and some humans may identify them, and others may not. Well, how did they get there? Just there. It's the old just there response. How do you understand the sense of command, the sense of obligation, moral obligation? Makes a lot more sense in a personal worldview. You know, if you've promised someone, you're obligated to them. Or if you've promised your country, you know, you think of a lot of people you're obliged to. But here, you're just obliged to a principle. That's just a thought injected in the universe for no purpose. Yes?
Would you go farther down this argument then with respect to the paper on that Theodore Sixth published on that tries to make this case that divine command isn't sufficient to dispute morally right or wrong because God
Yeah, well, see, he's got to sustain all the richness of moral theory apart from it being rooted in a personal being. So he doesn't have a commander giving a command. He has no teleological explanation for how we come to know these values. And they have to just exist apart from a mind as mere propositions. Now, one thing that he's doing in that article is he's using the old Euthyphro problem. But what is it about God commanding it that makes it right? Could God command the opposite of the Ten Commandments and they be right? We don't need God. We just need the principles apart from God because you have a kind of divine voluntarism. You might even say a divine relativism. God could have switched all the Ten Commandments around. Well, that misunderstands fundamentally the nature of God and Christian theism. Because God is a necessary being. God is a self-existent being. He's not subject to fluctuations from anything outside of himself. Moreover, I can't develop this adequately in 4 minutes, but God, I'll try next time, is a logically necessary being. God cannot not exist. God exists in all possible worlds. And I believe moral truths exist in all possible worlds as part of God's mind. So when you say something is right because God said it, you mean that it relates rightly to God's nature. God could not command someone to murder the innocent for fun. It goes against his nature. And the idea of a moral command itself doesn't make much sense unless you have a personal commander, a commander-in-chief, so to speak. And there's a classic essay we read in Philosophical Ethics by Arthur Leff that makes this case. It was in the Duke Law Review in 1979. And the guy is actually an atheist, but he says unless there is an ultimate lawgiver, it all boils down to anarchy. Now, what these people want to do, like Schlick, is say, no, we can have the moral principles and properties, make them objectively real without God, and then they give a caricatured view of divine command morality, which fits Islam, but does not fit Christianity. Because in Islam, Allah is so utterly transcendent and removed from the physical realm and the human realm, then he can do anything he wants. Anything. In fact, Muslims believe that he abrogates certain parts of the Quran. He said something, then he said, no, I don't believe that anymore. It's abrogated. That's this radical voluntarism they have. It's not Christianity. If you do some philosophical reflection on the nature of God, morality, and human beings, you see that God's commands are based on his nature. God is a necessarily good being. He's not subject to fluctuation, to arbitrariness, to fickleness. And he's created human beings in his image and likeness. So there is an ontological fit between his morality and our morality, between his mind and our mind. So he creates human beings in his image and likeness. You can't go around torturing them for fun and have it be good. Given the nature of God, given the nature of human beings, given the nature of the universe he's created. But what I want to ask people to try to have objective morality without God is, isn't it kind of a fluke that we came to know morality in the first place, given your chance necessity view of the universe? How do you explain imperatives? Moreover, this is a different kind of argument, but it can be cashed out. On this worldview, you are a moral loner in the universe. You're a moral actor, somehow, by chance and necessity. We'll just waive that for a minute. We'll bracket that. You're a moral actor, but you have to do it alone because there is no help outside of yourself to be a moral human being. You know principles, and you have your chemistry, and that's it. The Christian view, what is right and good is rooted in the person of God. It's made known to us through the commands of God. We know it through conscience. We know it through special revelation. And moreover, if we're rightly related to God, if we're forgiven, adopted into God's family, we have an entirely different moral dynamic in our lives, a supernatural dynamic. For not just knowing the good, but achieving the good. So there are a lot of very profound differences even between this view, which claims there are objective moral values in the universe, and a fully rich theistic view. I didn't get a chance to read my favorite quote. Can you hold on for 2 minutes? This is my Nietzsche quote. Some of you have heard this. I think Nietzsche had it down. And I think this is maybe a good way to summarize the moral argument in reverse, if you will. This is from a book which is titled The Gay Science. It has nothing to do with homosexuality. It's a German word which was earlier translated that way, The Gay Science. This book, you might think, well, what is this book called The Portable Nietzsche? And it's completely falling apart. You know, it's like if your portable Nietzsche is falling apart, your life probably is. But, you know that one about the Bible? Sorry, I'm getting punchy at this point. This is falling apart because I've used it so much over the years. I got this book in 1975 as a non-Christian studying philosophy at the University of Northern Colorado. And I read it. I tried to take it very seriously, and I've continued to read it over the years. But this is a very famous little parable called The Madman. Some of you have heard it. Have you not heard of that madman who lit a lantern in the bright morning hours, ran to the marketplace and cried incessantly, "I seek God, I seek God." As many of those who do not believe in God were standing around just then, he provoked much laughter. "Why, did he get lost?" said one. "Did he lose his way like a child?" said another. "Or is he hiding? Is he afraid of us? Has he gone on a voyage or immigrated?" Thus they yelled and laughed. The madman jumped into their midst and pierced them with his glances. "Whither is God?" he cried. "I shall tell you. We have killed him, you and I. All of us are his murderers. But how have we done this? How have we been able to drink up the sea? Who gave us the sponge to wipe away the entire horizon? What did we do when we unchained this earth from its sun? Whither is it moving now? Whither are we moving now? Away from all suns, are we not plunging continually? Backward, sideward, forward, in all directions? Is there any up or down left? Do we not feel the breath of empty space? Has it not become colder? Is it not night and more night coming all the while? Must not lanterns be lit in the morning? Do we not yet hear anything of the noise of the grave diggers who are burying God? Do we not smell anything yet of God's decomposition? Gods, too, decompose. God is dead. God remains dead, and we have killed him. How shall we, the murderers of all murderers, comfort ourselves? What was holiest and most powerful of all the world has yet owned has bled to death under our knives. Who will wipe this blood off us? What water is there for us to clean ourselves? What festivals of atonement? What sacred games shall we have to invent? Is not the greatness of this deed too great for us? Must we not ourselves become gods simply to seem worthy of it? There has never been a greater deed, and whoever will be born after us, for the sake of this deed, he will be part of a higher history than all history hitherto. Here the madman fell silent and looked again at his listeners. And they too were silent and stared at him in astonishment. At last he threw his lantern on the ground, and it broke and went out. I come too early. He said then, my time has not yet come. This tremendous event is still on its way, still wandering. It has not yet reached the years of man. Lightning and thunder require time. The light of the stars requires time. Deeds require time even after they are done, before they can be seen and heard. This deed is still more distant from them than the most distant stars, and yet they have done it to themselves. It has been related further that on the same day the madman entered divers churches and there sang his Requiem Arteum Deo. Led out and called to account, he is said to have replied each time, "What are these churches now, if not the tombs and sepulchres of God?" Think about it. Last time we developed the moral argument for God's existence, and remember, this is part of a cumulative case argument. Would someone like to give a short, succinct, and brilliant statement as to what a cumulative case argument is? It doesn't have to be brilliant. Short, succinct, clear, right. It's on the question. Yes? Right. You don't use any one argument in isolation from the rest. You use various arguments to make various points about the existence and nature of God. So the moral argument is concerned about God as the lawgiver and the judge, and also the one who fitted the world to comport with human purposes. That is, that life is meaningful all the way down, that human beings are not accidents, that we were planned to be here, to thrive, to obey God, to love one another. Now, that's all affected and warped and twisted by the fall, but that basic ontology remains. So when we're talking about God as the lawgiver, we're not merely talking about a being who is divorced from the creation, who's issuing edicts, but that a being who created the world with moral meaning, spiritual meaning, who is a good, kind, loving, and just God, who created us in his image and likeness to have dominion over the creation and to incarnate, if you will, to bring to bear truth and goodness in the world. So what is good is rooted in God's character. It's made known to us in his commands, the explicit commands we find in the Bible, such as the Decalogue and basic moral principles. But it's also made known to us in conscience. Romans 2, 14 and 15 speaks of the work of law written on the human heart. Even someone who's never seen a Bible knows that torturing the innocent is wrong, honoring parents is good, and so on. God has made us to know those things. We know them by virtue of being creatures. Now, the moral argument argues to an objective moral order, so you have to argue against relativism and anything that would oppose an objective moral order. Then you want to say that an objective moral order that transcends mere materiality, that transcends customs and language games, is best explained not as a brute fact, something that's just there, but best explained as being part ultimately of God. That the good is rooted in God. God is the source, the standard, and the stipulator of what's good. Now, one argument against that is, well, that makes the good arbitrary upon God's will. Either the good is arbitrary on God's will, so God could reverse the Ten Commandments and make them good, and that's a counterintuitive understanding if you believe there's objective moral order. Or the good is separate from God, in which case God is not really supreme and is not really the source of goodness. Now, the way to split that dilemma down the middle is simply to say that the good is ontologically basic in God, that God exists by necessity in two ways. He's the necessary being that upholds the universe, created and upholds the universe. That's the cosmological argument's deliverance. But God is also a necessary being logically, meaning that God exists in all possible worlds. Now, this is a bit controversial, but I'll just give you my take. God cannot not exist. So God is the reason for God's own existence and is not threatened by anything outside of himself. So the fact that the good is based on God's character is a necessary truth, but it follows from his character. Now, some people want to say, look, if basic principles of goodness are necessary truths, they're not contingent truths, they have to be true, they're true in any arrangement of facts you imagine, of possible worlds, then it can't be based on God's character. Well, it certainly can be. If God himself is a necessary being, then all of God's essential attributes would obtain by necessity as well. If you want to get more technical with that, I can give you material to look at. But most people will not bring that up. Now, people who say, well, look, you can have necessary moral truths apart from God, have to deal with the problem of moral obligation. If these moral facts are just there, not attached to a being, what are we actually obligated to? In Christian theism, we're obligated to a being. And also, the personality of God kicks in with respect to the arrangement of the world to be conducive to moral agency. If it's an atheistic world that just happens to have moral facts in it, even if they exist by necessity, they're not planned to be there, they're not coordinated with other states of affairs, then literally you're good for nothing. You're just good because it's good, and it doesn't comport with the overall fabric of the universe. Whereas goodness, let's say take the virtues of the Beatitudes, are conducive in the long run to flourishing. And the flourishing of others, right? Blessed are the meek, what? They will inherit the earth. See, those attributes, those character traits, fit into the overall fabric of the universe in the long term. Now, they also produce suffering. And in fact, Jesus even says that you are blessed when you are persecuted for righteousness' sake. We sometimes don't spend much time on that. And Americans don't have much of any theology of suffering, even though it's on just about every page of the Bible. We've managed to somehow omit that from our consciousness. So I don't downplay the fact that doing what's right may lead to suffering, which is why I said in the overall scheme of things, in the long run, doing what's right, doing the will of God, is good. It's good for the individual. It brings glory to God. It's good for the larger creation, whatever the short run crosses may be, difficulties, trials, tribulations may be. Objections, we already dealt with the arbitrariness objection. There's the objection that this destroys human autonomy, this idea of rooting the good in God's character. Well, the answer is yes and no. If you think for something to be moral, it has to be created independently and autonomously by a human being, you're right, it spoils human autonomy. But so what? If there's a good moral argument for the existence of God, if there are other arguments, design, cosmological, and so on, then you have evidence that converges on theism. So, tough luck if you want to create your own morality. You're cutting against the grain of the universe. Get over it. Now, I think some people might misconstrue Christian theism to mean that you have basically automata obeying commands that make no sense and which are given for no reason. And so people would say, I would rather investigate myself, I would rather cobble together my own moral system and my own moral life than live that kind of life. Well, I say, well, look, that's a straw man argument. Because if you understand the metaphysics of Christian theism, then there is an objective moral order, it's rooted in the character and commands of God, and it fits the universe that God brought about. So abiding by God's way, let's just call it God's wisdom, makes the most sense. It fits who we are. It comports with our constitution as human beings made in his image. Furthermore, while there are commands which involve character traits and actions, and consequences. There is, within that structure of commands and virtues, a lot of freedom, a lot of different ways to serve God according to your gifts, according to your abilities, according to God's calling. As Francis Schaeffer used to say, the Christian lives the freest life possible because we don't have to cut against the grain of the universe ethically. We can be reconciled to our Creator. We have a spiritual dynamic for doing good through the Holy Spirit that's not available otherwise. And we have an overall scheme of the world that explains good and evil. And we're creatures called to develop the world, to cultivate it and develop it. Genesis 1, Genesis 2, Psalm 8, and other passages. And in the development of the world for the glory of God and the good of others and for our own fulfillment under God, there's tremendous creativity in terms of your calling. Maybe you should be an economist. Maybe you could be a pastor, a professor, go into business, go into law enforcement, be in the military. There are a lot of different ways to follow God while sticking to the core of ethics. And there's a lot of openness and variation in terms of how you live your life. So there are standards. There's a framework. There are boundaries. But the idea is that within those, you can thrive and show creativity. One of the attributes of God that is demonstrated through the human condition is creativity. Now, God is creative to the maximal sense. He can create something out of nothing and create and coordinate the entire universe. We can't do anything like that, but we are creative. We're creative in terms of how we speak, how we write, how we dress, how we exercise, how we interact with other human beings, how we think and operate politically. We have a tremendous amount of creativity within the forms that God gives us as normative, as authoritative. Now, I think a lot of apologetic work needs to be done there because a lot of non-Christians have a false view of what the Christian life is like, right? I don't have to jam on it because I've jammed on it before, but a lot of non-Christians think that Christians are intrinsically anti-intellectual. You can't be free to think if you're a Christian. It's not true. And there are a lot of caricatures of the Christian life. Did any of you read the New York Times Magazine article on George Bush Sunday? One, okay. Really a hip audience here. I know you're busy. You're thinking, if you didn't give us so much work. Okay, I understand. You should try to read that, though, because it's a very hostile piece against George Bush because he's a Christian. It's very clear. They put him in the same category as the Islamic terrorists. They don't think critically. They don't care about reality. They don't care about facts. They think they're on a mission from God, so they're exempted from scrutiny and exempted from being advised by anyone. Now, that doesn't really fit the facts of Bush and his administration. There's a very good book out on him called Man of Faith by David Akeman, where he looks in more depth in terms of his character, his background, the sort of people he's accountable to. He's accountable to a lot of people, officially and unofficially. He doesn't just think he's doing God's will and doesn't care about the facts. It's just not true. But it's very clear from that article that the writer, who of course is a left-wing secularist, thinks that Christians have no critical abilities. In fact, it comes out and says it at one point. Faith is good for personal fulfillment and for healing wounds, but it's not good for analytical abilities. That's almost an exact quote from that article. New York Times Magazine. Millions of people will read that, not only getting false views about the president, but false views, more significantly, about Christianity. So a lot of the battle has to be waged there. Now, one thing you can't delete, you cannot omit, is the cross. The cross of Christ and the cross that he calls us to bear. You cannot omit that. That is not optional. That's not a preference. Jesus said in Luke 9 that there was a call, that he was issuing a call to deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow me. That's for all believers at all times, everywhere. You can't omit that. But nevertheless, we need to try to deal with false stereotypes, obstacles that people have about what the Christian life is like. And the best way to do that is to model it yourself with some integrity and to communicate it. Another objection is that, well, look, you can add God and add eternal life to the universe, but that doesn't necessarily give it meaning. This is Thomas Nagel's argument. Well, it depends on what kind of a God and what kind of a universe. If you're talking about Christian theism, then everything in your life counts eternally. Everything has meaning, whether you understand it or not. It may be inscrutable. But in the overarching scheme of things, everything has meaning and everything contributes to the kingdom of God in the final analysis. Now, if that's not meaningful, I don't know what is. It's not just, you know, as a secularist might put it, one damn thing after another forever. That's not it. It's life under God, for God, living in a universe that will be one day purged and restored, where everything will be healed. You tell me that's not meaningful? That's not significant? That doesn't, if you will, add value to your life? It adds value because it's true. So that's a loser. Some people say, well, this collapses into theological egoism. You simply want to follow God and obey God because you get what's better in the end. Well, it could be that the true and the good ultimately kiss. And in fact, they do. The true and the good in the final analysis embrace because they're one in the character of God. So if this is true, then it's good in the long run, in the overall scheme of things, for whoever follows Christ and follows the principles of his kingdom. What's wrong with that? But remember, in a fallen world, deny yourself, deny worldliness, deny sinfulness, deny the lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, the evil pride of life. Deny yourself, take up your cross daily, and follow me. And follow me. So there is denial and sacrifice, but it has cosmic and universal meaning. No sacrifice is meaningless. No sacrifice is moot. It's understood by God and ultimately recognized by God. We do it for the glory of God. We do it because it's right. But in the end, the good and the true unite. So the problem dissolves. I think part of the reason here that secularists can't understand this is because they're so constricted in their vision. They're so sort of theologically, cosmically, psychologically autistic. They don't dare hope. They don't dare think that the true and the good could ultimately unite in a personal, liberating, loving, and just God. Too good to be true. But it's not mere wish fulfillment. We're not just saying we hope it's true. We wish it were true. Maybe it's true. We're saying it is true. And there are reasons to believe it is true.